The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
Who to believe, prudent Pascal or lavish Leo? What is likely to be in the budget? Should all frontline workers get a pandemic bonus? No keys, no degrees, students bring their voices to the gates of the Dáil. And now that Sinn Féin is the largest party in the Dáil and the most popular in the polls, what next? We'll have all that and more on tonight's Late Debate. And joining us in studio to debate all of that, we have Fianna Fáil Senator Lorraine Clifford Lee, Paul Donnelly, Sinn Féin TD for Dublin West, Gary Gannon, Social Democrats TD for Dublin Central, and Grána Nié from the Journal.ie. And later we'll do some poll analysis with political scientist Dr. Kevin Cunningham. And we want to hear from you, so get in touch. You can text us on 51551, email us on latedebate at rte.ie, or tweet to @latedebate_rte. Well, it's that time of year when everyone in Cabinet is making cow eyes at the Ministers for Finance and Public Expenditure as they submit their wish list for Budget 2022. Before we go to our panel on this, let's have a listen to what the good people of North County Dublin told our Brian Lally about what they'd like to hear from Pascal Donoghue on Budget Day.
Yeah, fuel allowance for the elderly. Increase and extend it. You know, because it's going to be tough now with all the increases with the Greens taxes.
Well, I think the housing crisis is a mess, and I feel it's very sorry for middle-income families because essentially they seem to be the people that are screwed all the time. If it's rent, they've issues with rent, or they can't get on the property ladder, and they've creche fees and all the rest of it. So I think
the squeezed middle are even more squeezed every
absolutely.
Time.
Absolutely, and the squeezed middle have got larger and larger and larger, and people that were never squeezed are now in a worse position. So
I'd want to see some firm commitment to working from home and something that is actually cash in the pocket that shows working from home is worthwhile for both employers and employees. Even employers now know that people can work from home and produce the work. But working from home incurs costs, and it shouldn't be made as difficult as it is to try and recoup those costs. It's too difficult at the moment.
Less taxes, 100%, maybe for alcohol as well. That's very expensive here in Ireland. Maybe invest more in leisure activities for young people, like, you know, gyms and stuff.
Look after social welfare and look after the elderly. When the electricity going up and the gas going sky high, I think the pensioners need at least 20 euros.
20?
Yes. They pay their taxes. It's time to look after them.
What is the one thing that you would like to see in the budget for yourself?
Bring up benefits for everyone, really.
Yeah. Where does the money come from?
Squeeze the top end bit.
Wealth tax, big taxes on high incomes.
Yeah.
What's high income? Give me a figure.
Over 100 grand a year, maybe.
Over
100. Not fleece them, but it's more equal.
What about the old reliables? Do you think the old reliables will get a bit?
Not petrol now, but the rest of them, yeah, can go on up if they want to. But I mean, not petrol, but with people having to commute again and all that, they need to keep all those costs down.
The Greens want to increase carbon taxes, so that's going to hit petrol.
I know it is, yeah, it is. You never get the ideal solution.
Yeah, so that was some of our listeners talking to Brian Lally about their budget hopes. Mixture of altruism and self-interest, I suppose, there. But yesterday we did hear the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council telling TDs that the government is avoiding hard choices and needs to take a more prudent approach. Then Pascal Donoghue told the Budget Oversight Committee today that difficult decisions needed to be made over the coming weeks. And then Tánaiste de Leo Varadkar told business leaders later on that he's confident that the government is in a position to include a pension, a welfare and personal income tax package in next month's budget, and that income tax credits and bans will have to be index linked as well. So where does that leave us, Lorraine Clifford Lee? Who do we believe, as I said there in the opening, prudent Pascal or lavish Leo?
Well, it's really Minister Michael McGrath and Pascal Donoghue are the two that will be deciding what's in the budget. And I know they're working very hard between themselves and with their other cabinet colleagues. But I think there has to be thought put into how we protect vulnerable people in our communities. And that's like one of the contributors spoke about, people who will be suffering from fuel poverty because of the rising energy costs. We have and interestingly enough, that Vox Pop came from North County Dublin, a place that I live and know very well. And people mentioned the creche fees that people are facing as well. And families are under enormous pressure there. So
given all of that, why are we talking about income tax cuts?
we're talking about it in the context of rising inflation, and inflation is currently at 3% and it's to go further. So when we talk about widening the tax brackets, it's not about giving people more money in their pockets. It's just about levelling things up.
No, I think that's on top of a personal income tax package. That's what we're being told. We're being promised tax cuts and the tax bans and
well, I listen carefully.
Index linked.
I listened carefully to what Michael McGrath was saying on radio earlier today, and he said that it won't be the situation that people will be having more money in their pockets. It's just to level things up, given that the inflation rates are increasing, and as well as that, there are other substantial costs that are increasing, like the fuel and energy costs in people's lives. So it's just giving ordinary people a bit of a break. We've gone through a very difficult 20 months with the pandemic. Family incomes have suffered, and people are very worried about what's going to happen into the future because they see prices rising rapidly. So it's about being fair. It's about making sure that people are not worse off in the coming months, and it's to substantially address fuel poverty.
OK, Paul Donnelly, have you been paying attention to what the various kites that are being flown left, right and centre here?
Absolutely. And look, I always wonder when I hear words like prudence, you know, it sounds like cuts, sounds like austerity, that they're shaping, I suppose, the narrative in relation to that.
Nothing I've heard in the last number of weeks points to any austerity.
I hope that it's not just a covert word for that. I think what we need to do is we're in the midst of a housing crisis. We know that. Everybody admits that we're in the midst of a housing crisis. So there's no doubt about it. That has to be one of the primary focuses. We also are coming out of COVID, where we have nearly 1 million people who are waiting on consultants' lists across the health sector. That is something that we need to address. We need to address the cost of living. We're talking about carbon tax coming in, and everything is going to increase in relation to that. So when we talk about the most vulnerable in our society, they're the ones who are going to be most affected by something like that. So, you know, we are talking about a fair and equal budget.
Well, I think he'll be happy with what will be delivered in that case, Paul, because I think Minister McGrath has given a very strong signal, and Fianna Fáil has always acted to protect pensioners and very vulnerable
Gary,
people.
You want to jump in?
I do definitely want to come in. I think it's very important to say that we can't go back to the Bertie economics of 2007, where we can claim and tell people that we can't have both. We can't have massive tax reductions and also invest in public services. So for me, as a Social Democrat, one of the things we'll always prioritise is putting money back into people's pockets by investing in their cost of living. So Lorraine, as you said, we need to invest in childcare. We need to be investing in fuel poverty and looking at welfare rates and increasing that. But we can't do that at the same time we're talking about tax cuts.
I don't think we're talking about massive tax cuts. It's about widening the bands so the impact of rising inflation.
I'm just quoting what Leo Varadkar told business leaders this evening. He said that the government is in a position to include a pension, welfare and personal income tax package in next month's budget. And then separate to that, that income tax credits and bans will have to be index linked.
I don't think that's what people are demanding. That people are not demanding tax cuts. What
people
are demanding, that the government deal with the health crisis. They deal with housing. They deal with the most vulnerable.
Do you think they shouldn't have tax cuts, Paul Donnelly?
No, I don't think so. And I think what we need to do is, and that's what I'm hearing, and I'm sure.
Well,
that's
I think
what
if you listen back to the interview that Michael McGrath gave on the radio, it's a very different tune there. So
the difficulty? You've just nailed it on the head there, Lorraine.
Well, it's Minister McGrath and Minister Donoghue who will be dealing with the budget. With all due respect to the tarnished, it'll be the two of those, and that's not what I'm hearing from Minister McGrath.
But it won't be Minister McGrath and Minister Donoghue who will have to deal with the impacts of the budget if they don't increase the fuel allowance, if they don't look
absolutely
at where we can
provide
this money for.
Would the Social Democrats say this is no time for tax cuts?
The Social Democrats will always say this is no time for tax cuts. We've seen that story before.
Let me bring in Grainne Nihé. Grainne, what's your sense of how this budget is shaping up?
Yeah, there's a lot of talk there about what the government will be increasing, and I suppose it's how, when you talk about balancing things out, you know, there's an possible increase to the fuel allowance. Eamon Ryan said that they'd be cushioning people who might be at risk of fuel poverty. So that sounds like a fuel allowance increase. Minimum wage increase as well to, as Lorraine was saying, balance out the scales with inflation and other welfare payment rates will probably go along with that. And then the pensions issue was obviously huge in the last election. That's another issue that the government has to grapple with, but they said they'll look after older people. So it's all give, give, give so far. I'm kind of curious to see what the other end of the scale will be. And that's kind of going to be the big decider. The government has a real opportunity with this budget to kind of break the mould a little bit with away from the minimum increases to alcohol and cigarettes and whatever else, and maybe minimum increases to or tweaks maybe to welfare payments, and actually do something about the issues that the pandemic exposed: healthcare, childcare, care for the elderly. Those types of things are the things, and imagination around those things about how to improve those situations and not just keep them ticking over are going to be crucial. So whether it happens in the budget or not remains to be seen.
Yeah, I'm just looking at a text that's just come into us here and I suppose reflects something that one of our contributors to that Vox Pop said as well. All for protecting our elderly, but let's not think they're the only vulnerable. After tax, I earned $2,200 per month. When I've paid for my rent and my daughter's college accommodation, I have €400 per month left for bills and food. No hope of saving for mortgage, no tax credits as renter, no tax credits for daughter's college digs. Not happy if I hear social housing tenants will get welfare increases before I see a break.
Yeah, and these are people that I'm talking to every day, and that's a very, very difficult situation, and it's exactly those people that we're trying to help. One area that I've been personally campaigning for and been lobbying Minister McGrath in relation to is the provision of contraception, free contraception scheme, which was promised in the programme for government, and he has outlined that he hopes to introduce that. So I think that would make a big difference to women in Ireland.
You see that, like, that Stephen Donnelly is still basically at the door with the begging bowl out and hasn't got it confirmed yet that he will get funds that he's asking for, not just for that initiative, which is an important initiative and was promised at the time of repeal, but also funds for dementia care, hugely important area, cancer care, women's health care initiatives, the National Paternity Strategy, trauma care.
Mental health.
And this is before you even touch the 900,000 that are on the waiting list.
This is part of the budgetary process. Each minister goes with their list of asks and they lobby the ministers for the money to provide these. But the commitment is there and there the will of all parties in government to provide that particular scheme. But we have given a very strong commitment, particularly in the area of dementia care.
Okay, can I talk about the other issue that was dominating headlines today? And this is this bonus or this payback for frontline workers who went out there and worked through this pandemic. We're seeing that officials in government are getting very alarmed at the kind of money we're talking about here. Those figures really are quite stark. €377 million for if they, accept that demand for a 10 days leave for healthcare workers. That's just for healthcare workers, and then if you add in the agency staff, you have to pay to cover for those 10 days leave. You're looking at over €500 million, and then if you'd say, well, they're not the only frontline workers. What about the other public servants? We're over €1 billion. Like, where is this money tree going to come from? Gary, do you think that this is something that should be prioritised?
Well, lots of things. We can prioritise several things at once. We shouldn't escape the fact that our frontline healthcare workers put themselves in harm's way. Many work 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, and we can't step away from that, and it needs to be acknowledged. So, yeah, I do think the government need to be consulting with the unions, finding the best way of moving this forward. If we can't finish over 2 years, so be it. I still can't separate myself from...
I just read out a list there, and it's just a tiny part of the kind of priorities that the Minister for Health is facing. Should we be pouring €500 million into this acknowledgement of frontline workers when there are so many service users, and some of them will be those frontline workers themselves, who are standing in queues?
And then we're going to go back to the idea of actually what constituted a frontline worker during the pandemic, because I know when I was queuing up outside Tesco's in the middle of last year, the people on the front of the tills were putting themselves in harm's way. I will always come back to my belief that actually if we wanted to come out into a new republic post-pandemic, we look at what actually that constitutes. For me, that's found in childcare. Everybody would benefit from that.
Now, hang on a second. So you're saying don't give it in leave days or don't give it in payments?
I think they've made the promise. I think they've made the promises now and they have to stick up from that. I think this was something that they've already told frontline health workers they are going to get. There was a bit of a jingoism around it. And now that it's on the table, they have to fulfil that promise. But if they really wanted to do something meaningful, we talk about how we emerged from the pandemic and put money back into everybody's pocket. So when people were going into Tesco's and working, they had to find childcare. Their kids were stepping up and doing the childcare for them. For me, that's what New Republic would look like, investing in those things that actually get people back.
Is there an issue, though, that, you know, frontline workers, and obviously, you know, it was an extraordinary, there was sacrifices made and people put themselves in harm's way, you know, at a time when people were very, very worried and scared about what, you know, potentially could happen. You know, in the air, particularly in the early days, I think, when, you know, we were worried about PPE and all those issues. But there may be, there's a whole other bunch of people out there who would have loved to have been in a position to go to work during the pandemic and couldn't because, you know, their jobs were shut down by government order. Now, they'd be entitled to think, hang on a minute, like, you know, all those frontline workers got paid. And they didn't take a financial hit during this.
You've hit the nail on the head there. There's been great public solidarity throughout the pandemic and great cohesion among everybody, and everybody has worked to the best of their ability in whatever line of work, whether it's, like Gary said, the people working in Tesco, whether it's the guards, the train drivers, the bus drivers. So the government has given a commitment to this, and it's a part of a Labour Court recommendation, and I know that the government is engaging with the unions to see the best way to deliver this while maintaining that social cohesion, because there are a lot of people in the public service that aren't frontline health workers but are like prison officers and bus drivers and what have you, that put themselves in harm's way as well, went over and above the call of duty. And then there are other people in the private sector. So I think we have to be careful about this, because a lot of people lost out. A lot of people put themselves in harm's way. And how do we? We're not out of this pandemic. We have to maintain social cohesion with everybody. And I don't know if rushing headlong into dividing people and giving some people and other people feeling,
and leaving other people behind. Paul Donnelly.
I think in the first instance that the trade unions, there needs to be serious negotiations and talks with the trade unions, who represent the workers. But I think we need to just cast our mind back to when this pandemic started. And people were terrified. People were unsure about what the impact was. Was it airborne? I remember at the time there was even a debate whether it was airborne or not. And these people stepped forward every single day, 12 to 14 hours every day. They stuck the PPE gear on. They put the masks on and gloves on. And they went in and they put themselves in harm's way to support really, really sick people. And there was huge fear in the community about exactly what it was and how this was going to impact. And they stood up. And I think,
as did Tesco workers. No, not Tesco, but every retail worker Tesco, that went out.
I would say
to Tesco, well,
pay your workers.
As did every person who went absolutely out. I think cleaned offices.
That's another dimension. I think we need to start looking at, actually, those workers can no longer be expected to live just outside the realms of poverty. So we're talking about a living wage for those
pay
workers.
Pay the workers.
Now. Actually, get into an argument about a living wage moving forward.
This is a very
difficult.
This is a very difficult issue, because to a certain extent, everyone sacrificed something or did something possibly brave in doing their job during the pandemic. There's a huge cohort of people out there who went out to work when it was a bit riskier. They were nervous about it, when they were worried about putting their family at risk. And everyone, to a certain extent, sacrificed something. There is an argument there for everyone. So that's why it's a bit tricky. On the other hand, healthcare workers were going into environments where they pretty much knew COVID was going to be there. They knew they were going to deal with COVID positive patients in some cases. They were dealing with a system that was already buckling under pressure when the pandemic hit. And they went in anyway, and they risked bringing COVID back to their families, knowing that they were dealing with a COVID patient who are obviously very sick, and it's a very stressful, fraught environment, saving someone's lives. I think it is on a different scale than the kind of work during the pandemic that other workers did. And that is why the conversation around payment, and particularly days leave, because these people worked extra hours to try and save people's lives, is in the conversation. However, if the government, I see the position the government is in where they don't want to ignore the work that other people did as well during the pandemic, Gardaí teachers, shop assistants, as was said. So it is a tricky issue, but I think it's worth looking into.
But there seems to be some division in government on this. I'll just ask, put this one to you, because the Leo Varadkar is saying in the Dáil today that it was his strong view that bonus payments or extra leave should not be limited to frontline workers in the health service. Is that the view across government?
I don't know. I presume it would be, because it would be my own view, because there were a lot of people who weren't healthcare workers. But I take Grainne's point that healthcare workers went in and dealt with very, very sick people. And I know nurses, doctors, ambulance drivers that lived away from their families for months on end, like away from small children, because there were vulnerable people in their households. So I think there is a particular case to be made for that. But that being said, a lot of people went over and above to keep us safe. And like, I remember the start of the pandemic, those terrifying days and people that went out. So I think we have to, as a society, see how do we reward people, because it was, and we still are, in a warlike situation, and it's an extraordinary situation, and it should definitely be marked.
Just a couple of texts in on that. Nurses just want the safe staffing they were promised after our strike nearly 3 years ago. Don't know any hospital where it's been rolled out. That's from Trina in Dublin 24. The best way to give frontline workers something is to let them be tax-free on their pay for a few months. That says Pat's idea. And why should anyone get a pandemic bonus, says Jerry in Limerick. Where are all these people not paid? They have their jobs, which is more than many. Come on, folks, we are broke. Okay, speaking about being broke, student accommodation. We touched on this last night, but it was in the news again today because, of course, the students were outside the Dáil protesting about the lack of available or indeed affordable accommodation for students across the country. I think we have a clip of Piers Doherty raising the issue with Leo Varadkar in the Dáil earlier.
And it's a situation that's been made worse as a result of the provision of tax breaks to those who were supposed to provide purpose-built student accommodation, only for many of those units to be now repurposed into tourist accommodation. And yet you'll trot out, as you've been doing in the media, about Fine Gael wanting to see tax cuts in this budget, while at the same time people like Sandra can't put a roof over their head. While there's 1,000 students in Waterford that don't have a home, and students right across the state can't find accommodation.
And then things got a little hot and heavy.
You said earlier on that the people on these benches, on the government benches, should be ashamed. You know, maybe you should ask yourself whether you should be ashamed too. Your party voted to increase rents in Northern Ireland in a pandemic. There is never, you never miss, and you've been.
People dying in their sheds, Deputy, without running water, and you Deputy, should be ashamed. And a bit of humility from you would go a long way.
And a bit of humility from you too would go a long way. Last Concordia, with the usual display, truth hurt, they go mad, drives them crazy. They increased rents in Northern Ireland. They never miss an opportunity to oppose housing here in the South. Never.
Would you listen to the voices of the people? Forget about what we're saying. Listen to them, Taoiseach, and a bit of humility. And maybe look at it through the prism of the individuals as opposed to the landlords and speculators who you are always on their side.
And that was Dáil Exchanges earlier today.
I think that's just typical Leo Varadkar. It's typical when they're under pressure and they understand and they know that what they're doing is not working, that the crisis out there is hitting people time after time after time, whether it be families, whether it be people who are homeless, whether people in HAP accommodation, hotels, BMEs, and now students that have raised the issue. It is typical for him to go and deflect away from what he should be doing.
OK, we don't have a Fine Gael rep in tonight, so it's you'll have to defend Leo Varadkar. Lorraine, I know you'll want to.
I'm not going to pass comment on that exchange, because I don't think it becomes either individual that was involved in that. We're talking about a very serious situation that students, people I've been speaking to, are dealing with. And both sides, both from Fine Gael and Sinn Féin, trying to throw insults at each other doesn't serve anybody.
I don't think there are any insults. Well, it was facts that were being presented, and then Leo Varadkar tried to...
Inflammatory language was used on both sides. No, if I could just...
A woman who was living in a shed with no water, that's not inflammatory. That is absolutely
Can I just continue with the point?
In this day and age.
Can I continue with the point I was going to make? The situation facing the students is absolutely appalling, and I would appeal and to all the local authorities around the country where these purpose-built student accommodations are built in. mainly here in Dublin, in the north inner city and the south inner city, and there's over 10,000 beds. Some of these have been granted temporary permits to provide other forms of accommodation, like tourist accommodation. They should be rescinded immediately, and only student accommodation, students to be housed in these purpose-built buildings. And if that business model isn't working for those providers, they're going to have to drop their prices. It's absolutely outrageous that they had been given incentives to provide this accommodation. I don't know why conditions weren't provided within the planning permission that was granted to them, which would forbid them for providing any other form of accommodation. But there are beds that are there that could be used by students. They're unaffordable. They're being used by tourists into the city, and it needs to be addressed. We're in a perfect storm situation.
If only we were in government.
Hang on, there's a classic problem with the housing situation. It's market developer led. You nailed on.
If I could just say, it's a perfect storm between we've an increased number of students going to third level. You've got an overall housing crisis. So it's all coming together. Something has to be done. There's no quick fix at the moment for this, but we need to be planning more strategically. And I would be very much in favour of
government. I know you're not in government, Lorraine Clifford, but you are the government representative here tonight. And the idea that
I'm not going to defend something that happened in a Fine Gael led government 5 years ago. And that's what happened. Then we weren't in government. We're only in government.
We will then go on to talk about housing for all and where that's going to take us.
Just to be clear, what's happening on the moment in Dublin and in Galway and places like that is students are booking into hotels and hostels while tourists are booking into purpose-built student accommodation. Why isn't Owen Keegan and Dublin City Council planning section being absolutely hauled into the doll to be asked, how did this ludicrous situation be allowed to develop? So I'll take any opportunity to bash the government that comes my way, and I have done today in races for the issue. But Owen Keegan and Dublin City Council enabled this scenario, and they shouldn't be allowed away.
But it's not just a Dublin problem.
It absolutely isn't.
This is obviously a real open goal in terms of how did this happen and how was this allowed to happen.
It's a perfect example of why the approach to housing isn't delivering for people. So it's not surprising that the private sector has not provided affordable accommodation to students just the way it hasn't so far, I'll admit, provided affordable accommodation in other areas of the housing sector. And this, if we take this as a canary in the coal mine for how private sector won't deliver on housing in other aspects because it is not affordable for people, and there's nothing the government can do after it's already built, that they should take that as a warning. And when we're talking about the approach to the housing crisis, the ESRI has already weighed in on how the government's dealing with it. It is becoming a kind of a matter of fact thing that the way the government is handling it isn't working. That being said, Dara O'Brien has a shiny new plan ready to kind of solve this, and I think we should give him a chance to give it a go. But people are angry. I think the student accommodation protests is a good encapsulation of how annoyed people are. The reaction to Leo Varadkar's statement in The Gaul earlier this week, where he said landlords taking rents in as an income should be considered and should be remembered, and how angry people were at that, is an encapsulation of how frustrated people are waiting for politicians to deliver on something they said they'd fix for years and years and years.
Yeah, let's talk about Housing for All, because the president of Dublin City University was out on this today, and he's saying that the section in Housing for All, which was to deal with this is lending universities money to build more accommodation. He said this is uneconomic, it's based on a false assumption, and it doesn't take into account escalating construction costs, and it will only result in more accommodation that will be beyond the capacity for their students to pay.
Well, actually, what he said was a welcome first step, allowing the ITs borrow money. But what he said also was that he wants the Exchequer to get involved in part funding the accommodation to make sure it's affordable. And that's something I would very much welcome. And it's something I'm going to be speaking with Minister O'Brien in relation to, because this is acting as a serious barrier to education for a whole swathe of young people right across the country, particularly people who are outside the main cities in rural Ireland.
That a plan that was just unveiled a few weeks ago has already been given that analysis by the president of Dublin City University. What he said,
it is uneconomic.
He didn't say,
based on a false assumption.
He didn't say that about the housing plan. He said that about the construction costs currently. The allowing other educational institutions access finance was a welcome first step. I listened back to the interviews and it was a welcome first step. But what they needed to make sure that...
But he said it's not going to fix it. That's the core
what he said.
What
would fix it would be if the Exchequer agreed to part fund, along with educational institutions, to part fund the construction of these, and then that would make it affordable. And I'm sure it's something that Minister O'Brien is going to look at, because Fianna Fáil has always...
He has only just published the plan. Why are we already saying this is something now we need to look at?
But this commit, like the plan, is always something that can be added to. It's the principles laid out in the plan. But Fianna Fáil has always supported access to education, whether that's second level education and third level education. And I'm sure there's going to be substantial increase in the Exchequer funding to provide third level institutions with the funds to actually tackle the student accommodation crisis. But the current crisis is not of Fianna Fáil's making. These luxury student accommodations built in our cities, but particularly here in Dublin. But we're now dealing with it, and there is a plan there, and you have a minister who was committed to solving this.
Ryan, I find it incredible that you've just said that the housing crisis is not of Fianna Fáil's making.
We haven't been in government for 10 years now. I know, Paul, you like to fool yourself with myths that are put around, but we weren't in government. We weren't in charge of the housing brief, and we are now.
You didn't collapse the economy through the absolute reckless...
Paul, if we want to get into who damaged the economy of this country, I can tell you the
absolutely shocking.
What went on for 30 years on this island through terrorism has actually done more damage to the economy.
So we're talking about housing
here. No, you're talking about people wrecking the economy.
I said wrecking the economy, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you, 30 years of terrorism on this island wrecked this economy.
2016 election, right on to Fianna Fáil.
Well, look, if you want...
Confidence and supply supported them every step of the way. And now you're in government.
We're in government. And we've published a very substantial...
A very...
Like, Paul, if you want to go and look at the commentary around the Housing for All plan, people like Peter McVerry and other eminent people involved in housing have welcomed the housing plan. And I know Sinn Féin does not want it to work out. And I know that you're opposing housing left, right and centre because you don't want the crisis solved.
Where?
All across the country.
Name one.
All across the country.
Tell you what I oppose. I oppose co-living developments. I oppose developments that are completely out of the reach of ordinary people.
Sinn Féin opposed up in North County Dublin.
Vulture groups who come in.
You're opposing
support affordable
development
and social
in North
housing.
County Dublin.
There would be just practical solutions.
Okay, we have one voice, please, because nobody can hear anything at the moment.
There would be just practical solutions that we can agree on outside of the pun and the punch and Judy show of what's happening in the Dáil every single day. And that's simple things like banning rent increases for 3 years. Surely we can agree that the Housing for All plan has this link to inflation. Inflation is going up by 3% this year. That's not going to do anything for anybody. Could we not just agree that a ban on rent increases for 3 years would actually make a substantial difference to people, either be they students, be they elderly people? And that would be a common sense solution to an issue that's clearly not going to be addressed through the Housing for All strategy.
Gráinne.
I agree. But there's no political will to really tackle the rent issue. You know, the kind of issues that renters face, the deregulation of it, the quality of accommodation out there and just how high they are. It is incredibly high. It's just there's no political appetite or no discourse either about fixing it. And that is to do with, I suppose, protecting votes. It's to do with the demographics in the Dáil as well, I would say, to a certain extent. And it's a huge part of the housing issue. And it's why we're seeing things like student or purpose-built student accommodation that everybody was told at the time wasn't what was needed. And it got built anyway. And now, in hindsight, we're learning that's not really working. The kind of back and forth over housing, like a lot of issues, it just needs to be depoliticised.
it, you know, I've filled out my doll or political retort bingo card here listening to politicians argue. It doesn't work for people.
Well, that's the point, actually, Grainne, that the president of DCU, Dara Keogh, made today in relation to this, that we need to depoliticise the student accommodation and just put some practical measures in place. And I think one very good practical measure that would solve or maybe help towards the current crisis was put forward by USI in relation to the rent-a-room scheme and encouraging people who might have a spare bedroom in their house, if they're in an urban centre near a third level, that they would open their homes to people and take in a student, and that maybe that tax-free allowance for people who take tenants into their house and take lodgers in would perhaps be increased to encourage more people to take people
in. We're getting a lot of texts in on this. Government needs to adequately fund on-campus university-owned accommodation instead of allowing for a free-for-all to private landlords, says Kieran. When it comes to voters making up their minds about who to vote for in the next election, Leo Varadkar is Sinn Féin's greatest asset, says another texter. And here's one. Spare me the rhetoric. I live near UCC. The amount students are spending on drink, deliveroos, taxis, fashion, phones, grooming, cars, makes me laugh.
Washing themselves.
College roads like a catwalk, both male and female. I have no pity.
Oh, it's changed since my day, definitely.
I have no pity, says that texter. Okay, look, we leave that one there because have we got Kevin on the phone? Yeah, I want to move on to this issue, because Sinn Féin now is, of course, since Mark McSharry resigned the Fianna Fáil whip, Sinn Féin is now the biggest party in the Dáil. And as of this month, all four public opinion polling companies put Sinn Féin as the most popular political party in the state. Meanwhile, Fianna Fáil is struggling. I think we can all agree, in the opinion polls at least. Now, here at Late Debate, we would never engage in tittle-tattle or idle gossip, so we've invited Dr. Kevin Cunningham from TU Dublin and Ireland Thinks along to talk about the popularity of Sinn Féin and Fianna Fáil. To your faces, Lorraine and Paul. Dr. Cunningham, you're most welcome.
Thanks a million. Thanks, Katie. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you were writing about this in the Irish Examiner today, this the rise and rise of Sinn Féin and the failing fortunes of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael on the other side of the equation. You had an interesting analysis of the reasons behind this. Like, Sinn Féin have gained votes in every election, I think, was it for the last eight elections?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they've gained over the last eight elections. And actually, that period, I mean, if you go all the way back to 1980, the kind of 40-year period since then, it's a period of quite substantial change. You know, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have steadily declined over that period. And at the same time, the demographics of Ireland have changed. Religion used to be, you know, 80% of people used to attend church on a weekly basis. And now it's sort of 20%. And so...
Yeah, can I ask you about that? Yeah. You tie political affiliation to religiosity, I suppose you could say, or you know, affiliation.
There's a couple of clues to it. There's a couple of different academic papers that show that if you look at the relationship between class and voting behaviour, if religiosity is relatively high, then, say, working class voters are more likely to vote for a more right-leaning party. And if it's lower, then they're more likely not to do so. If you were to, you know, take the most recent election, the 2020 election, and just look at people who attend church on a weekly basis, you actually refit what the old system used to be. Fianna Fáil is the largest party, then Fine Gael, and actually Sinn Féin's on around 12%. It's like you're putting back the system that used to be there, with the kind of 2.5-party system. But there's an idea that when people aren't religious, that they're more likely to vote for a left-wing party. And we've seen over that 40-year period, if you go back to 1980, only around 16% said that they were left-wing. And now today, it's 38%. So it's a quite a substantial and steady change. And it's one of the big changes in Irish politics, I guess.
And you may have picked up... that row between Lorraine and Paul just a few minutes ago about the Sinn Féin's past in relation to the Troubles. And there is a view maybe that younger voters are attracted to Sinn Féin, and many of them may not have been around or, you know, have listened to those news bulletins, you know, grew up with those news bulletins looking at atrocities night after night, and that that might be increasing support in that age group.
Yeah, and I, you know, I wouldn't know necessarily exactly what everyone would know about the Troubles. But, you know, if you go back to the last general election, Sinn Féin were doing just as well among people who are aged 45 to 54 and 55 to 64. So sometimes I think it's a mischaracterization of the Sinn Féin vote to assume that they're all just very, very young. In fact, Sinn Féin's best demographic isn't the youngest, because the youngest demographics are actually competing with the Social Democrats, with the Green Party as well in particular. So I sometimes think that I'm not really sure if that's a driver of it, because a lot of the Sinn Féin voters are actually a little bit older. And you know, the biggest drivers aren't that, it's kind of things that whether the person themselves are left wing or whether they're working class or whether they espouse populist views. And in fact, the populist views are probably the strongest element in the Sinn Féin vote more than anything else, even though most of them are kind of left wing.
And define populist for us, because a lot of people think populism is about saying popular things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you often hear that. I mean, certainly academics have a view of the term populism that isn't necessarily the same as, I think, the way people talk about it more generally. We think of populism as being almost a strategy of political parties to juxtapose the ordinary sort of morally pure people versus some sort of corrupt elite. So it's this kind of corrupt elite and the emphasis of that. And the Sinn Féin vote is quite clearly very strong on this particular issue. In fact, it's the best predictor of a Sinn Féin person as opposed to someone who votes for another party is their perception of the level of corruption in politics. So if they think corruption is very widespread, they're far more likely to vote for Sinn Féin. And same with trust in politicians and all that sort of stuff. It's similar. It's a similar thing in lots of different countries. There are lots of people who do have these strong views about politics and the political system. And Sinn Féin have definitely captured that particular vote.
Okay, Kevin, stay there on the line, would you? Because I just want to open this up to the panel. Do you recognise a lot of that, Paul Donnelly? I'm just thinking that the Catherine Zappón story was manna from heaven for your political base. What Kevin Cunningham just said there kind of explains why you ran so hard and fast with it.
Well, I think a lot of people over the last number of decades, and if you look at, you know, what Kevin was talking about from, say, the 80s up to now, and the dramatic fall in the support for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, you know, can be linked to the fact that both parties have been involved in corruption. Both parties have been involved in planning corruption, and in all of that went on the tribunals. So, you know, I'm sure there is a correlation with that, but I think people are much more forward-thinking in relation to the politics and who they vote for. And they're looking for, not in the past, they're looking to the future, and they're trying to figure out which is the party that represents my views, represents what I believe in, and can also deliver on housing, deliver on education, deliver on the things that matter to them. And I've been at many elections and I fought many elections. And that's, you know, I got incredibly strong feedback from the last general election about people saying, we've had enough. We've had enough of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael for the last 100 years. And we want something different. And they're looking at Sinn Féin and say, we like the people who are representing yourselves on housing, on finance. Piers Doherty is incredibly popular. Eoin Ó'Brien is incredibly popular. Louise O'Reilly, Mary Lou. We've got incredibly good people who have produced incredibly good policies. And that's what people are looking at, and they're saying,
Lorraine's going to explode here if I don't
look to the future.
If I don't let her in. I'll let you respond to that in a second, but just in relation to, I was looking at Teresa Reedy was writing about Fianna Fáil in the Independent yesterday, the Irish Independent yesterday, and basically saying, you know, it was all right once upon a time. Fianna Fáil stood for power, and it was almost always in government, and that's all it needed.
Fianna Fáil always stood for a lot more than that,
but it didn't need to make the hard calls that other more niche political parties had to make. Whereas now she is saying that it needs to decide where it stands on the big issues. It says, The internal review of its performance at the general election had many sensible recommendations, but it skirted the big question, which is, what does Fianna Fáil stand for? The party will not be able to avoid this question for much longer.
If I could, before I answer that, touch back on to Kevin's wider article that I read. And he actually said the majority of people who voted for Sinn Féin voted for them not, like Paul said, because of where they stood on housing or health or whatever. It was because they weren't Fianna Fáil or Sinn Féin. Fine Gael. So they weren't particularly sure actually what Sinn Féin was going to do or deliver or what it stood for other than not being them. And I thought it was very interesting as well what Kevin said about, you know, the populism and the huge support of populism within Sinn Féin as well. And what he described it as, you know, the distrust in the authority, the media, the establishment, juxtaposing ordinary people against some kind of a corrupt elite, them and us. And that's a very worrying trend. And Sinn Féin are feeding off it in politics today, is polarising people and making people into, you're either fit into this group of a corrupt elite or you're in this other good group. And, you know, we've seen that abroad. We've seen Trump do that. We've seen other populist leaders do that. And I would be very, very worried if that trend continued here.
What does Fianna Fáil stand for?
Fianna Fáil always stood for ordinary people trying to make a go of it, a fairer society, a fairer community, access to education. We introduced free second level education, which transformed this country. We brought peace and stability to this island, which allowed economic prosperity. We modernised Ireland through Sean Lamass.
We're very much in the territory of eaten bread is soon forgotten. If we're back to Lamass now.
Well, let's talk about what Micheál Martin did.
Lorraine,
he prioritised public health through introducing the smoking ban. Fianna Fáil introduced the plastic bag tax.
I want to let Gary in, but I mean, the question I asked you is what you stand for now, because
I just said that. We're a Republican party. We stand for ordinary people,
who doesn't
supporting
stand for those things?
People, like supporting communities.
Who doesn't stand for those things? Which part? What would be the ideological underpinning of Fianna Fáil? Because I look at you in the chamber there. I seen Mark McCherry resigning the other day saying he was a democratic socialist. I see other people across Fianna Fáil would say they're on the centre right. There is no real identity or an ideological underpinning that unites.
That's what you might think, I'm very, very clear.
I think
about
seen the picture of Fianna Fáil standing out there with the vote, all the Fianna Fáil members standing out there voting no to abortion.
I was in a picture that I campaigned heavily for a yes vote. So I know, Gary, that you might want to paint Fianna Fáil and all of us in a certain light for your own.
But now you're doing the thing that you accused Paul of, where you tried to say that I'm either we is or against it. That's not what we're saying here.
You just said you saw a picture of all Fianna Fáil.
No, that's the picture that people will see.
You said the
important national questions.
Sean Fleming raised in that internal thing, that picture, that image of the majority of Fianna Fáil parliamentary party members posing with the picture and being very vocally on that side of the repeal argument was damaged, particularly with younger voters.
It overshadowed the involvement that myself and others, a very strong involvement with years in the repeal movement and the work that we did within our communities. Yeah, so it definitely was pointed out, and it's used by other parties to paint a false narrative.
That was in your own internal report, in fairness, Lorraine.
But it was in the report because that picture then was used to paint a false narrative.
One more thing,
about where Fianna Fáil
stood. Fianna Fáil, we
have a minister for health at the moment who is doing transformative work for women's healthcare in Ireland.
Gary.
I wouldn't mind deconstructing that to you in terms of exclusion zones outside maternity hospitals.
He's introducing legislation, Gary, and he is.
But even also in relation to Sinn Féin's rise, I remember my first election in 2014, my first council election, when Sinn Féin swept the board across all the councils, and 5 years later, their numbers were cut by less than a half. So I do think there is a space for all of us to be advancing our own positions, because the 2.5 party system has broken down, and now it comes to, well, what do you stand for in terms of housing, what do you stand for in terms of health? And I think that brings us a more healthier form of democracy.
I think Fianna Fáil was a party for everything before, and that worked because it could represent everybody's views, it could bring in kind of wide ranging policies, and every type of person could vote for them, and that's why they were in power for so long. In a new and a shifting political landscape in Ireland, they're asked to be more specific about what they stand for. And that is going to cause some kind of wranglings within the party, particularly because they've been in government so often, there's so many things that people can hold against them. It's the opposite problem Sinn Féin face in a lot of ways, because they've never been in government, they have this sheen on them. That's why you see Leo Varadkar bringing up their policies in the north, and Lorraine mentioning there the troubles, because there's no policy kind of track record from being in government to hold against them. Once they go into government, and that does seem inevitable, that will go as well, and they'll become like all the other parties.
I want to bring Kevin in on that, actually, because you do touch on that in your Examiner piece today. Wavering loyalties, that Lorraine brought it up there, the fact that a lot of the vote, people who voted for Sinn Féin, say they did so because they weren't Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael. They were anybody but that can be a double-edged sword.
Yeah, I'm increasingly of the view that until an election is called, it's actually relatively difficult to know what's going to happen at the next general election, because we see increasingly there isn't that loyalty to political parties in general. As Lorraine mentioned, there isn't that loyalty to Sinn Féin either. One other example of this, as I mentioned in the article, is Podemos, which was a left-wing populist party in Spain, got 25% in 2015, and now it's 10% in fourth place over there. There's lots of evidence in recent elections. The German election happened this Sunday, and you can see the parties going up and down like billiard balls over the last couple of weeks. And same for Canada, also the UK 2017 election. You know, parties seem to move around. And in fact, the 2020 election itself, you know, if you look at the trend in the polls up until that election, it was only when the election itself was called that people suddenly decided they're going to vote for Sinn Féin. So I think it's quite uncertain what will actually happen at the next general election. And there isn't that loyalty to Sinn Féin. You know, the Mary Lou's leadership ratings aren't much higher than Micheál Martin's or indeed Leo Varadkar. So there isn't this massive surge of support, particularly for the Sinn Féin message or anything. It is more, or at least it seems to me at least, to be more in opposition to Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, especially in open-ended responses.
Paul Donnelly.
Yeah, look, I think everyone, when you win an election, you win. Look, I mean, my last election I got 6,000 votes, and I got 12,000 votes in the 2020 election. There's a lot of people out there who did look to Sinn Féin for the first time, and they made a conscious decision that they were going to give Sinn Féin a chance, give an opportunity to see if we could form a government, see if we could go into government and do the things that we say we're going to do. And our responsibility and our job is to put the policies in front of people and say to people, when we get into power, we are not going to be like the others. And it's our job when we get there is not to be like the others.
But if you spend all this time
for working people.
If you spend the time you have propagating the idea that, you know, government politicians are, you know, corrupt or cannot be trusted, or they're different, they're elites, they're not like you, ordinary people on the street, and then you become the elite government politician, it's a bed of nails, isn't it?
Well, look, I would hope, I don't ever expect to become them. We are Sinn Féin, we have our own unique identity. We are a party very much in tune with what people are thinking at the moment. And again, look, the polls, particularly since 2020 general election, we've consistently either in the last few months we've gone up by 3 or 4 or 5 points, and we've consistently stayed there. And I genuinely believe it's because people are looking at what we're doing in Dáil. They're looking at how we're holding the government to account.
But you got the exact same vote in the by-election.
And we're also presenting them with alternatives. We're presenting them with things that we would do differently. And that's, I think, why people are looking at Sinn Féin and saying, yes, they are the party that I want to lead the next government.
Well, you see, the more Sinn Féin leads the opposition, the more kind of part of the establishment, and they're on, like, you know, quite naturally on every panel. And I think the point that Kevin was making was that they thrived on being the outsiders, and that the others were the bogeymen. And as they move towards the establishment, which you naturally would, being a party of your size, it'll be interesting to see if that vote will actually stay with you.
Do you think Sinn Féin are going to be in government after the next election?
I don't know. As Kevin has pointed out, and pollsters have pointed out, and as we're seeing in the Canadian election, the German election, in other elections all around,
The polls are, and the figures are in flux, and people change their mind, and I think people change their mind during the course of a campaign. So I don't know. I think it's all
to pay for. What do you think, Gary?
I think their trajectory suggests that they will be. Yeah, I think it's looking that way. They do have some high quality performers in the Dáil, but I think the job for the rest of us in terms of in opposition is to emerge to it. I think the Social Democrats, we also have some very high performers in the Dáil. I think we've got some great candidates around the country, and we need to be able to make sure that we're being heard also. That's the
Kevin, I know you said it's just impossible to call because of the volatility in the polls and then what happens when people actually have to make a decision. But do you think this rise, it is inevitable that ultimately Sinn Féin are headed into government?
I think Sinn Féin, I mean, Paul points out that there is one particular advantage that Sinn Féin do have in sustaining this vote. And you saw it when the sort of rally around the flag happened, where it really increased their support in the middle of the pandemic. They didn't really make any dent into the Sinn Féin vote. They took votes from everywhere apart from Sinn Féin. And I think one of the reasons for that is also the homogeneity of the Sinn Féin vote in terms of it being left-wing, but also being particularly working class. So it is a quite a cohesive vote. So it's hard to see Sinn Féin completely disappearing in the same way that many of the other parties, you know, don't have the same sort of floor. They have a much lower floor, like Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael could easily collapse into one another as one rises, the other might fall. So I don't know. The other thing about the Sinn Féin vote is, you know, from the Social Democrats, there's a lot of overlap between the Social Democrat vote and the Sinn Féin vote in terms of there is some level of populism within the Social Democrat vote, but also it's very distinctively left-wing, and there's a huge overlap there. So there's a risk to Sinn Féin that the Social Democrats might actually take some of their vote as well, and perhaps on the other side aim to actually has quite a lot of similarities for to the right of the Sinn Féin vote. But I think overall, it seems likely that Sinn Féin will be the largest party. If you're going to pick one, it would have to be Sinn Féin, obviously, because the government probably isn't going to get more get more than 45%,
Okay, I'm going to have to leave it there. We are out of time for tonight and for this week. I want to thank my panel. Thank you all for listening. My thanks to the production team. Stay tuned for Colm Murray with Late Date next. But first, over to Siobhan Madigan on the Sports Desk.